Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with something I have written, which necessitates a disclaimer that it is my opinion, and perhaps only my opinion, in all the expanding universes. The impeachable president. And I started with a quote from Mohandas Gandhi. Immediately the subject ceases to fear the despotic source, its power is gone. And it was Gandhi. It is time to discuss impeachment with serious intensity. The president has disgraced the nation and imperiously downsized its reason for being. Outright abrogation of the national secular Ten Commandments, otherwise known as the Bill of Rights, arrogant disregard for the Constitution, which was conceived by revolutionaries wary of domestic tyranny, a war shirker who fancies himself a Magna Caesar of vast military omnipotence. Donald Trump is a fraud, an instinctively mythomanic deconstructionist who vilifies democratic liberty and rule of law. A swaggering bully whose grossly inarticulate mouth is a sewer of lies and hate. And besides all of that, he was not legitimately elected by popular vote, which in a justly functioning democracy might very well be his first impeachable offense, on par with his fraudulent taking the oath of office. Yet a significant number of Americans are afraid of him, or worse, claim to worship him, which, paradoxical to his meager character, makes him the most dangerous and menacing chief executive in the nation's history. He has assumed the mantle of In God We Trust, yet he baldly pursues the Mephistophelian ambitions that threaten to sell out the nation's soul. He rips away the fabric of democracy he is pledged to uphold and lavishes wealth and power upon a family dynasty and a compliant, homegrown ethnic aristocracy that is avaricious for racial supremacy to subvert a diverse hodgepodge of racial pluralism. To cyclop his corrupt pretext with the revolutionary vision of the nation's forepersons, an inaccurate term intended to embody the full range of founder ancestry, he is, in a sense, imitative of them as a traitor to his country and a political terrorist, except they rebelled against tyranny while he is determined to reimpose it upon the ordinary citizenry of the nation, in particular, non-white citizens, a disparity the original ancestors left to a later generation to dispel. Also, the ancestors who created American democracy were generally out in front of the storm they conjured, while he is sheltered far behind the battle by layers of publicly funded safekeeping. And his only apparent use for democratic rule of law is to shield himself from his own perpetual criminally unlawful behavior, and to imprison, and perhaps even, given the recent restoration of the federal death penalty, to execute a few, if not all of them. Donald Trump the man is not very much, despite his blustering Nero-cissistic ego and Nero-neurotic aura of self-divinity. But it cannot be stressed too often that Trump and his cabal of hoaxers, fakers, and artless con artists are exactly the domestic political hoodlums our ancestors most feared would eventually abdicate their hard-won liberties and civil rights. Benjamin Franklin candidly predicted that eventually the country would become so lax and corrupt that it would not only allow but eagerly embrace for its own selfish comforts a domestic despotism that would more or less readily dissolve their obligations and responsibilities to be active citizens enlarging and protecting democracy. And of course, the despotic putsch would be in the names of sacrosanct liberty and justice for all, simultaneous to their eradication. And subjugation would claim as pretext Christian values, obviously in conflict with separation of religion and state. A major notion of the ancestors was for the common people to be able to censure or remove corrupt or tyrannical officials without resort to revolution, vigilantism, or assassination. When rights are plugged, dramatic relief becomes a conceivable option, which of course the corrupt and or despotic political bosses attempt to forestall and perhaps quell with increased police powers to protect their illegal repeal of the rule of law. The Trump presidency is essentially carrying out an Orwellian-style disenfranchisement of democratic governance in which the citizenry are divested of power as well as any voice in its use or intent. And if history provides an insight, the majority becomes unnerved or angrily apathetic rather than manifestly revolt. Dismantling the democratic process to successively award a small ruling claque would obviously demonstrate the inherent fragility of democracy. And Trump's arrogant onslaught has certainly revealed the glass house of American constitutionalism. As if that were not enough, an argument for Trump's impeachment, he has also recklessly escalated the development of nuclear weapons in tandem with his czarist mentor, Vladimir Putin, of revenged Russia, contradictorily renewing the Cold War nuclear arms race, which might be a conspiracy of power affiliation directed at the rest of the world, China most likely in particular, and perhaps to also neuter NATO. Conspiracy intrigues, real or fake aside, Trump has squandered the world's goodwill and sympathy, with the exception of a few despotic pestholes, by his arrogant and bullying bellicosity, breaking treaties and alliances, declaring preemptive trade wars, blocking America's borders to immigrants and refugees, as well as flaunting militant nationalism and misogynist racism globally. He has made the United States the currently most despised nation in the world. Even if there might seem a scant case for impeaching Trump, standards for which Republicans lowered considerably in their repeatedly failed campaign to oust Bill Clinton, it is evident that a significant number of Americans are exasperated by Trump's turbulent tantrums, thinly disguised as executive policies. However much the GOP is striving through Trump to attain absolute one-party rule over USA politics and government, it has from the very start imperiled its position with insolence and transparent mendacity, as well as conspicuous disregard for the Constitution, unmindful that civil and political power is ostensibly in the hands of the people, however much that has lately been disputed or diverted. The prospect of impeachment might seem an ineffective method of removing the president and curbing his atavistic abduction of inappropriate power, but it is essential to what power to the people is all about. From the moment he staged his descent from the top of Trump Tower on the golden escalator, as though he were descending from the heavens to announce his campaign for the presidency as God's chosen man, Donald Trump has, by his every act of vile cruelty and venal corruption, coupled with his reflexively vexatious, fetid smog of perpetual lies, has disclosed himself to have instead been analogously raised from the pits of hell. Trump's official presidential portrait should represent his genesis as hellspawn, painted perhaps like Joachim Probst, an American artist whose portraits stripped symbol portrayal to the literal bone, or Astoria's own Karen Bain, whose family portraits, quote, capture the soul on paper, unquote. Trump should be painted in fiery striations of red, as though his bloated face were fault lines of demagogic insanity, crowned with a sponge-like splotch of orange atop his forehead. He should be shriekingly open mouth, in fulminating rage, staring straight out from the canvas, through cruel eyes to intimidate anyone who dares look at the portrait. And his malevolent, igneous eyes reflect a mirror of hell. And that was the impeachable president. This Saturday, August 17th, is my friend David Horowitz's 78th birthday. He is a historian and professor emeritus at Portland State University, where he has taught for 51 years, since 1968. He has written much about the KKK, and I'm going to read a piece he wrote for my newspaper and also published elsewhere, my paper being the North Coast Times Eagle, and right now I'm messing with the pages to get the right ones. Tales of the North Coast Klan by David Horowitz. 95 years ago this summer, Clatsop County was proud to host the statewide convention of the Ku Klux Klan of the Realm of Oregon. Between 5 and 10,000 Oregonians gathered at a Klan celebration in Astoria, welcomed to the North Coast by the city's mayor, a friend of the Secret Order. Klansmen proudly marched in public procession through the streets of Astoria and Seaside, conducted naturalization, and that's a quote, ceremonies to induct an additional 150 members, and gathered for the dedication of new Klan headquarters in the county seat. The Ku Klux Klan even sponsored the runner-up candidate in that July's Miss Astoria pageant. Nationwide membership in the Ku Klux Klan peaked between 2 and 3 million in the mid-1920s. Oregon had the highest per capita Klan membership of any state in the Union, and Clatsop County followed Portland with the second highest Klan membership in the state. One-fourth of the adults in the county may have been enrolled in the Klan and its auxiliaries. Reestablished in 1915, the second Ku Klux Klan confined membership to native-born white Protestant males who took secret oaths of loyalty to the order. Klan literature boasted of the organization's dedication to pure womanhood, white supremacy, the Constitution, uncorrupted religion, freedom of speech, the common people, and public education. Klan polemics focused on the need to assimilate foreigners, non-Protestants, non-whites, and political radicals to the American way. When moral supervision proved ineffective, Klansmen frequently resorted to other methods, although acts of outright terrorism and violence actually were rare in the 1920s. Local claverns often employed economic boycotts, social ostracism, and political pressure to accomplish their aims. Klan organizers built on long-standing animosities toward Roman Catholics in Oregon to create a powerful movement in the early 1920s. The election of 1922 produced a Democratic governor elected with Klan support and a voters' initiative which nearly abolished Oregon's private and parochial schools. The compulsory education measure, subsequently ruled unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court, would have required children between the ages of 8 and 18 to attend public schools. One school, one flag, one language, Klan organizers proclaimed in the successful grassroots campaign. Klan influence in the state legislature also produced a 1923 bill prohibiting ownership of land by aliens. Governor Walter Pierce, acknowledged as a fellow Klansman when he appeared at a secret meeting of the La Grande Clavern in 1922, gladly signed the land bill. Although the Ku Klux Klan played upon ethnic and cultural hostilities to build a powerful fraternal organization and political movement, Klansmen genuinely appeared to be concerned with the moral tenor of life in the burgeoning 1920s. What concerned them in particular was the growing cosmopolitan nature of America's cities and towns and urban culture's increasing neglect of the moral values of the past. This great drama took on intense proportions in the two centers of Oregon's North Coast, Tillamook and Astoria. Tillamook County's Klan organization listed 195 members on its rolls in mid-1926. Many were substantial dairy farmers, retail merchants, and professional people from every population center between Nehalem and Hebo. The Tillamook Clavern engaged in the patronage and financial activities typical of a fraternal organization with substantial political priorities. It dutifully sold subscriptions for the Oregon Clan's Western American newspaper. It collected dues, money for Klan robes, and contributions for Klan charities, nearly $400 during March 1924. It also encouraged Tillamook County members to support the candidacy of a local American Legion commander for director of the state mental institution. This is the first political appointment that Tillamook has ever asked for, and we deserve this one, local Klan leaders exhorted their following. But Tillamook County faced growing social problems with the expansion of the regional economy in the 1920s. Oregon scholar William Toll has pointed to the disruptive effects of the period's logging boom. New opportunities attracted both transient contractors and a rough and migratory workforce that threatened the older families of the towns. Newspapers in Tillamook County reflected this discomfort with hysterical treatment of the dangers presented by the organizing attempts of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, or Wobblies, a nationally organized labor union which espoused workers' control and an end to the wage system. Klan officials in Tillamook avoided ethnic issues and attacks on Catholics. But in Astoria and Clatsop County, KKK moral concerns merged more directly with the nativist movement so strong in Northwest culture. The Astoria Clavern attracted 900 members at its peak and a total of 2,000 between 1920 and 1926. Native-born hostility to Catholics and the Finnish community worked to give Klan candidates a sweep in the 1922 city elections. Klan support contributed to victories for the new mayor, four newly created city commission spots, and the county sheriff. But when the newly appointed city manager refused to cooperate with Klan patronage plans, the order pushed its political power by instigating a recall campaign through petition. This was going too far for most native-born Astorians sympathetic to Klan goals. The city manager was able to counter the Klan purge by linking it to outside interests. "We don't need Portland men to tell us how to run our business," he proclaimed in effective response to Klan harassment. Astoria's feisty city manager may have been the only man in town to publicly defy the Ku Klux Klan. A Catholic attorney was forced to end a speech at a 1922 meeting of the Astoria Law Enforcement League when he accused the Klan of divisiveness. "You can't say anything against the Ku Klux Klan from the rostrum," objected the pastor of the host Methodist church. The circulation manager of the evening newspaper then reinforced the minister's protest. "I am one of the wardens of the church. You know this church is anti-Catholic. I won't allow you to speak as you have been talking," the morning newspaper headlined, "Squabble at Purity Meet." Native-born Astorians were even more threatened by the city's large Finnish community. In the aftermath of World War I, Astoria veterans formed an American Legion post in 1919. Its motto was, "Alien slackers must go," and it attempted to arrange the deportation of foreign men who had not served in the war, particularly Finns. At one point, the Legion tried to pressure one of the local canneries to fire a suspect Finnish worker, but the company refused. The veterans also attacked the editors of the Finnish language newspaper for failing to publish wartime ads for the Red Cross and the Liberty Bond campaign. Suspicion concerning the loyalty of the Finns created a perfect climate for the Klan's crusade to rid the region of foreign influence and preserve a culture familiar to native-born Americans. During the 1922 initiative drive to ban parochial schools, Astoria teachers formed a One Language, One People committee. Its goals reflected Klan desires to teach Americanism and stress the importance of speaking English. Newspaper reports indicate that Astoria school authorities gagged a Finnish boy for 3 months during classes to demonstrate the evils of speaking the foreign tongue. In another incident, a girl was expelled from school for speaking Finnish over the telephone. She had been speaking to her non-English-speaking mother after her father had been injured in an accident and sent to the hospital. Klan authorities connected the alien problem to their anxieties over moral stability in a changing culture. The pages of The Western American, the official state newspaper of the KKK, reflected this concern in pointed language. Published in Astoria by Lem Deaver for several months in 1922, before relocation in Portland, Western American editorials lectured subscribers on Klan moral and political duties. Immorality and degeneracy were increasing in America, Deaver warned, 3 weeks after the 1922 election. He argued that love of money and the natural depravity of the human mind were responsible. The church had lost its appeal and power, he complained. The people were to be found at the movies, mad for pleasure, power, ostentation, and class. The Klan's mission, an accompanying editorial preached, was to Americanize the alien hordes which infested the country. A Klan statement in the same issue summed up the findings of nativist sociology. The greatest danger facing the American Republic today is the graduate replacement of our religious, social, and political foundations by those of alien origin, quote, unquote. The Astoria Klan saw itself as a purity crusader in an increasingly secular society. Newspapers reported that a group of Klansmen marched into a meeting in the basement of the Astoria Methodist Church in May 1922 and left an $80 contribution. The money was to go to the building of a children's home in Corvallis, a project of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Deaver and other Klan leaders saw Clatsop County as a lucrative den of corruption, criminality, and vice. Editor Deaver claimed that Astoria was the center of a mail-order divorce mill. On another occasion, he described a local political meeting dominated by bootleggers, cheapskates, shyster lawyers, and preachers, gunfighters, and crooks. The description may have been exaggerated, but as a port city, Astoria found it difficult to enforce liquor prohibition laws. The issue was crystallized when the Morning Astorian printed an open letter to the Clatsop County Sheriff from Pacific Klan II in June 1922. The unsigned letter warned that if the sheriff failed to clean up questionable resorts in the county, the Klan itself would take direct action. The ultimatum described ruthless, open, and repeated violations of the Prohibition Code. If the sheriff did not clean out the Whistle Inn near Flavelle, as well as several other joints in the county, the Klan promised to take prompt and drastic action. The letter even hinted that the Klan might clean out county offices not enforcing the law. The sheriff's response was to call for evidence of prohibition violations so he could prosecute. Meanwhile, he stated his office would not be run by other organizations. Nothing ever came of the Klan threat, but the letter was a public example of how the secret order sought its goals. By the end of 1923, however, when Deaver broke with the Oregon Klan, the organization had peaked, both in Clatsop County and in most parts of the state. Only in Tillamook County, where the Klan functioned primarily as a fraternal order, did KKK activity carry on substantially into the latter 1920s. The 1920s Ku Klux Klan, unlike its more violent, racially intolerant successors following World War II, was a fraternal order and political machine whose emphasis lay with moral character, and that's a quote, and the values associated with native-born Protestants. The Klan provided its adherents with a way to face cultural change in a spirit of ethnic and social solidarity. The narrowness of its focus is obvious, the potential for bigotry and intolerance enormous. Yet, as William Toll has suggested in his own scholarship, the 1920s Ku Klux Klan of the North Coast spoke to those frightened by the social and moral consequences of modernization. Klan crusades proved divisive and carried the potential for unwarranted hate against those who had their own moral codes and traditions. Nevertheless, North Coast Klansmen, like other Americans of the 1920s, found themselves trying to resolve the knotty contradictions between economic growth and its unsettling consequences. One can never condone bigotry and cultural intolerance, but those who follow history can certainly appreciate the dilemmas which plagued our predecessors, even if they did not resolve them in ways which stir reverence and pride. And that was Tales of the North Coast Klan by David Horowitz. And his article about the North Coast KKK at the time was a public presentation of research under the auspices of a grant from the Oregon Committee for the Humanities. And just in case anyone caught the fact that I, in the beginning, said 95 years ago this summer, it was actually, when David wrote it, 60 years previously, but I updated it for today's program. And now, today, August 15th, is my first cousin and first best friend Linda Comby Compeyshanti's 79th birthday. Yesterday, August 14th, was Julie Conception's 74th birthday, which was also the 74th anniversary of the end of World War II, Victory Over Japan Day, or VJ Day 1945, which was the day she was born. And I wrote a poem about her. Julie and VJ Day. You might have been named Victoria Jane. You knew a girl who was. Poor girl, you said. You are 50, VJ Day, the day you were born. The World War ended. Millions dead, gone, never more forever. You are new life, born amidst burial. A sad world you make warm. You unconditional mother. You wonderful woman. I love you always. Julie and VJ Day, a poem which I wrote. VJ Day has two claimants, the second being September 2, 1945, when Japanese diplomats formally signed surrender documents aboard USS Missouri, the battleship that visited Astoria in 1998. Michael Horowitz, David's brother, was born that second VJ Day. He will also be 74. He is dean of the University of Tonga and a novelist. Julie's granddaughter, Winter, was 15 on August 5th. She is riding rodeo at various summer fairs, including the Oregon State Fair. August 18th is Judy Nyland, Astoria's Theater Madonna's, birthday. And August 7th was my beloved niece, Tracy Ann McCusker's, 36th birthday. She is a published poet, and I will read one of her poems. Ants and Beetles. It was summer. I was laying by the patio outside of the house. A beetle caravan crossed an ant trail through the slits in the bricks. I picked up a beetle, scrawny legs, flailing for a foothold. I skewered it with a stick. It looked like a smashed blackberry as the ants carted the body away in small, juicy bits. I've seen ants cart away all manner of things. Once I saw something on the sidewalk like a smashed peach, broken, red, pink. The police quickly set up yellow barricades and waved the people away. All of the cameras were pointed just left or right of the smashed thing. I stood on my tiptoes to see it, but someone covered my eyes. Hushed as she led me away, she cooed, "It is his plan. God must play with beetles, too." And on August 10th, 1776, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and John Adams, principal authors of the Declaration of Independence, suggested that e pluribus unum, Latin for out of many, one, as the motto for the Great Seal of the United States. This is Michael McCusker.